The Infrastructure Show is brought to you by Wyss Janney Elsner Associates, engineers, architects, and materials scientists, solving complex problems in contemporary and historic structures since 1956. Learn more at wje.com.
Welcome to the Infrastructure Show. I'm your host, Professor Joseph Schoffer of Northwestern University.
And I'm your co-host, Tom Herman.
The Infrastructure Show is designed to present to listeners the reality of America's infrastructure, its condition, why it is the way it is, and what can be done about it.
The state of California has been a world leader in earthquake safety building codes, starting with the California Seismic Code passed in 1933 after the Long Beach earthquake. In spite of code changes and advances in design standards, retrofitting buildings to meet new codes continues to be a challenge. For example, following the 1971 San Fernando earthquake, 1,777 California public school buildings still did not conform to the school seismic safety standards passed by the state legislature 38 years before. The main obstacle was the cost of the retrofits.
Although the San Fernando earthquake led to still more advanced design codes, the Los Angeles Times has reported that many concrete buildings in the city do not meet current seismic safety standards, putting their occupants at risk in the event of a major earthquake. Once again, the cost of retrofits was cited as the major problem. To help us explore the topic of seismic retrofits, particularly of concrete buildings, we're talking with Dr. Greg Brando, professor of engineering practice at the University of Southern California, who's a leading expert on the seismic evaluation and retrofit of buildings. Greg, thanks for talking with us today.
It's a pleasure.
First, can you tell us a little bit about the major earthquakes that have affected Southern California and how they've driven changes in building codes?
Okay. You mentioned the Long Beach earthquake, and that was 1933. That was sort of the earthquake that started the seismic provisions in building codes. And since then, there has been several earthquakes that had an impact on the codes. The 71 San Fernando earthquake that you mentioned changed a lot in our building codes in terms of trying to make buildings more ductile, more earthquake resistant, especially to large earthquakes. And then subsequent earthquakes like the 1979 Imperial County earthquake, the Whittier Narrows earthquake, and the more recent 1994 Northridge earthquake all have basically damaged some buildings severely, and they all had implications on terms of changing specific requirements of the building codes to improve the performance of buildings.
So in a sense, the earthquakes are experiments from which we can learn and then modify codes to prepare for the next one. Is that a fair description?
That is. And the basic problem is you can't take a building and put it on a shake table and test it ahead of time. You have to sort of wait till the earthquake comes along and see how well the building performs. And then, use that knowledge to improve future buildings.
How do the seismic codes differ for new construction versus upgrades? Are retrofitting, particularly in terms of the effectiveness of code enforcement?
Well, there's only a few sort of mandatory retrofit requirements in the codes. There are some voluntary requirements in the codes, and there are some general standards that are sort of nationwide now that set standards for retrofit. Typically, the retrofit standards are a lesser standard than the requirements for new buildings, in that you're really looking at trying to make buildings life-safe in a earthquake. And the retrofit standards barely make the buildings life safe, and the new codes kind of ratchet it up a little bit higher to make the performance of buildings better and life safe.
But are there codes in place that direct property owners to retrofit an existing building?
There are, and it goes sort of by jurisdiction. The city of Los Angeles is probably one of the jurisdictions that has done more to retrofit buildings than others. It started with retrofitting what was called unreinforced masonry buildings that were made out of brick that really had no steel in them. And these are buildings that were built prior to 1933 Long Beach earthquake. They're still around. And the city of Los Angeles is pretty well mandated that all those buildings have been retrofitted by now. Other jurisdictions, those buildings are still in existence. And then the other class of buildings are industrial buildings that are tilt-up construction, have big, large buildings that typically have wood roofs and concrete walls around the outside. Those performed really poorly in both the San Fernando earthquake and then later in the Northridge earthquake, and there are ordinances in place that those buildings have to be retrofitted.
So I would think in a building like that, a tilt-up building where you have the walls are either poured in place or brought to the site and then raised to vertical position, that you would have lateral stability problems.
That's right. The real problem with that one class of buildings is that those heavy walls would pull away from the roof, and then the wall would fall outward and the roof would collapse inward.
About how many buildings in Los Angeles do you consider to be at risk today? What types of buildings, where are they in the city?
Well, the ones that's gotten most attention lately, there are actually two classes of buildings. One is the what's called concrete non-ductile buildings, which are concrete buildings built generally prior to the early 1970s, probably from the 1950s to the 1970s, multi-story buildings that can be up to 20-plus stories in height that just we know aren't going to perform very well in earthquakes. So that whole class of buildings is the one that's been sort of focused on in the LA Times articles. And then there's another class of buildings which are called soft-story buildings, which are buildings which are sort of weak on the first floor due to a lot of reasons. Some of them may be apartment buildings where the first floor is primarily parking, and the buildings are wide open on the first floors and don't have a lot of strength or stiffness, and they're vulnerable to collapse on the first floor. So those two classifications of buildings are the ones that are probably highest on the priority list.
So in the second class, as you describe it, the image I'm getting is a building that may not have many shear walls in them to prevent that side-to-side movement.
That's right. I mean, that's the problem. You have parking or you have a lot of public space on that first floor and the shear walls are getting in the way. So the buildings are therefore sort of weak and soft on the first floor.
Yeah, I want to take you back to a word that you've used that I want to make sure our listeners and I understand, and that is you talk about ductile buildings, and that to me means a building that can take some lateral movement but not fail under that movement.
That's right. And the idea of seismic design of buildings is that you don't make a building that's not going to get damaged in an earthquake. The earthquake can be quite large and has quite severe ground shaking. So you don't really design a building to be damage-proof. You design a building to be able to accept damage and accept it in a way that the building still is going to be stable and safe. And to do that, you try to have a building where the damage doesn't occur in the columns. It probably will occur in the beams. And the damage isn't drastic. It's sort of yielding, sort of bending, and those elements aren't going to break or shatter.
And you mentioned a couple kind of buildings that are particularly at risk. What are typical retrofits for each of those kind of buildings?
The typical sort of the easiest retrofit is basically to add walls, add both stiffness and strength to the building by adding shear walls on those floors that are vulnerable.
So if it's a parking garage, does that kill the purpose of that floor as a parking garage?
Well, you can lose some parking stalls, or you can, if you put the walls on the perimeter of the parking, it might hinder either the access to the building or the ventilation of the building. So you have to be kind of wise in terms of where you put shear walls. They're also a kind of a safety issue in terms of occupants. They don't like dark places behind shear walls. So, you have to kind of work around a strategy that accomplishes better seismic performance as well as, keeping the building functional.
And when you talk about shear walls, are those walls that are bearing, not bearing? What is a shear wall?
Shear wall is just a wall that can resist the lateral movement of the building. And it can be either a bearing wall, which means it helps hold the building up, or it can just be a wall that's added in there as a supplemental wall.
Is it connecting the outside walls? Is that how it's helping hold it together?
Yeah, ideally, when you add walls to a building, they line up with the walls in the upper part of the building and help transfer those forces all the way down to the ground.
We pause our podcast for a moment to thank our sponsor, Wiss Janney Elsner Associates, engineers, architects, and material scientists who are solving problems throughout the built world. Visit their website at www.wje.com.
So if you think about reinforced concrete building that needs some kind of retrofit, do you do that with more reinforced concrete or do you put steel bracing inside the concrete?
You could do either. I mean, it's easiest probably to add concrete to a concrete building and add walls. But sometimes you'll see these buildings add, large X-braces, steel X-braces. And sometimes that is done just to keep the building more open where if you added a wall, you're sort of closing in the exterior. We've retrofitted buildings. My former company, where we've just added steel bracing on the outside of the building, it doesn't really impact the view out the window. You can see, you know, around and past the bracing.
I would think, though, the architects of those earlier buildings, if they're still around, would not be happy with what the building looks like.
It could totally change the look of the building, yes.
But I've seen the steel bracing in the Bay Area, where what looks like a relatively modern building has apparently very heavy steel X-bracing on the interior. Is that a common strategy?
Yes. I mean, especially if the building is, you know, you don't want to change the exterior look of the building, then you could add bracing usually in around the, what's called the core of the building, where the elevators and restrooms and things like that are, where you can, you know, put bracing and it won't disturb the occupants too much.
And I'm sure it varies from project to project a lot, but about how much does it cost? And do you ever get in a situation where someone says, you know, it would be more cost effective to knock this building down and build a new one to code?
Yeah, I mean, I think every time you look at retrofitting a building, that's always one option. You know, many times buildings are historical, so you don't want to tear them down just for that, from that standpoint. But it is very expensive. The actual structural expense of the building doing the retrofit isn't probably the biggest expense. It's kind of going into the building and tearing out finishes and doing the structural work and then putting all the finishes back that gets to be pretty expensive. And in some cases, you have to move the occupants out while you do the work, and that's even another big expense.
Speaking of occupants, do you think, because you're right, you'd have to make a sale to occupants if they were going to move out or they're going to have to bear with a mess while the work was being done, their finishes being torn up and then redone. How aware do you believe occupants are of the risk of the building? Do they welcome this kind of change, or are they resistant, or what kind of reactions do you get?
Boy, generally they're pretty resistant. I mean, that's, you know, it's sometimes discouraging because you'll go talk to a building owner and explain that their building is at risk, and, you know, just the expense of doing the retrofit sort of scares them off.
Now, I understand that from the perspective of the owner who's already got lease contracts and is making the same money, but I guess that's the decision maker, right? It's from the tenant's perspective. If they're a tenant, maybe they're okay with the work being done because they're the one that's living in there.
Well, that's right. And I think a lot of tenants just don't understand the risk that they have in certain buildings. I mean, the word doesn't really get down from the owner back to the tenant that the building does have risks.
You don't sell that to tenants when you're trying to rent them a building.
Yeah. I mean, basically, you got to remember an owner will, unfortunately, probably tell the tenants that the building is code conforming, which means that it's built under a building code and it conformed to that building code. And typically, there's no retrofit that's required of the building, so therefore, the building is not non-conforming.
So is there a way that a tenant or a buyer can get an objective assessment of the seismic condition of a building before they move in?
Yeah, typically a buyer will, because a buyer has to deal with insurance companies and banks, and they'll have a due diligence done on the building, and they will know generally what the risk is. So buyers are pretty aware. I just say, you know, tenants aren't in the same position. I don't think they would know what the risk is.
Are there any pressures from or incentives from insurance companies to improve the resilience of these older buildings?
I think there is, in that they won't give you insurance unless you meet certain standards, you know, where your performance, you know, is better than a baseline performance.
And if you approach the owner of a building, and let's say that they want to do the right thing, are there monies available to them to help bear the economic cost of them doing a retrofit?
I don't think generally there is. I mean, for public buildings and you know, universities and things like that, there's some FEMA money at certain times that is available. But generally, you know, I don't think there's money floating around.
So, and I'm just imagining then, in terms of someone who owns a building is trying to make it work economically, it would be probably pretty hard for them to stomach the cost of retrofitting it if they have to do it themselves.
That's true, and you know, especially that you get a high-rise apartment building or something like that. That you know, it's managed by a homeowners association. You know, they just don't know how, you know, how are they going to raise the money to do that. But you know, some of these buildings are, you know, 50 years old now, and you know, they just aren't anywhere near have the seismic performance they should have.
So by implication, the one thing I'm getting from your message is that we do know better how to do this job. We do know better how to design buildings and perhaps how to retrofit. Is that a fair statement?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. The seismic performance of new buildings is far better than what it was 20 years ago. We learned a lot in the last 20 years.
Are there new materials or substantially different design strategies that we could take advantage of or that we are taking advantage of to protect the occupants?
In terms of retrofitting or in terms of new building?
Well, both. I mean, we start with new buildings. I mean, are there new technologies that we can take advantage of?
There are. I mean, there's such things as putting dampers in buildings, which are like shock absorbers in a car, that will actually dampen the earthquake motion of a building. You know, those kinds of technologies are available, not used too often, but they improve the seismic performance of a building considerably.
Yeah, I'm thinking you may see them more commonly in some very large or unique buildings, you know, where you do something with the make the foundations more resilient or put a tune mass damper near the top.
Yeah, you see it in really, really tall buildings. A lot of time it's just for wind loads, but that's kind of a different, the tune mass damper is primarily a wind load issue. But just putting the typical viscous damper, which is like a car shock absorber, can be put in any building, you know, and it does improve the seismic performance. Just sucks up the energy of the earthquake.
Is it reasonable to expect that the conditions in the northern part of your state are similar to what you have in Los Angeles in terms of risk and response to that risk?
It is. In the big cities, San Francisco, you know, has had a push to retrofit buildings for over the last 20 years. So they're very similar to Los Angeles. But you get in the outlying counties and, you know, you don't see the push anywhere near the same as you do in the big cities.
And how does that push take place? If there's not city money available for private owners, at least to help them do it, what form does the push take?
Well, usually, you know, the city will create an ordinance that says that you have to evaluate your building, and then develop some plans to retrofit it, and if it needs to be retrofitted, and then you're given a period of time, you know, maybe 10 years or something, to do that retrofit to make it as economically feasible as you can for an owner, so you don't mandate they do it immediately.
Okay, so if it's done politically, it's done through new regulations and then through inspection, regulation, and then enforcement over time.
Over time, yes.
Is that taking place in L.A.?
You know, the city of Los Angeles is looking at you know, potentially two ordinances, one for concrete non-ductile buildings and the other for these soft story buildings.
And we had mentioned a story, and you had mentioned a story in the Los Angeles Times. Did that raise awareness of this?
Oh, yes, yes, definitely. Politicians don't tend to wake up unless they see something in print.
Well, or maybe unless there's another earthquake. And that leads me to ask, so are you and people in your profession prepared to learn from that next earthquake? And what are the processes that are followed?
There's been a long-term learning from earthquakes study that the Earthquake Engineering Research Institute has done, boy, as long as I've been practicing, where they'll go and actually survey the damage from an earthquake and then write reports and spread that information to everybody. And from that, you know, researchers and practitioners will join up and you know, decide what needs to be done to improve our building codes.
And as someone who studies these seismic effects and the retrofitting, were the information in the Los Angeles Times that sort of woken some people up, was that news to you or was that stuff you've known for a long time?
Oh, that's stuff I've known for a long time. Actually, I helped them gather some of that information.
Were you one of the people that brought it to their attention?
No, not directly. The primary author is somebody who's been kind of tuned into this for a while.
Yeah. And you had mentioned having a company before. If you had sort of two careers, one where you were working in the field and now in academia, or have you done both at the same time?
I've done both at the same time. I've been teaching since 1971, so I've been teaching a long, long time, but only doing it like one night a week. So I phased out of my company, which was called Brando & Johnston, and now I teach half-time at USC and just do some consulting the other half the time.
But I imagine the work that you do in the field is important in terms of staying current with what's going on for your teaching.
Both directions.
In both directions,
You have to keep current to be able to teach, and then practice is something you can bring to the university, which really the students like.
Yeah, and the students need that because they're going to be the next generation that's going to go out and design those new buildings and protect the old ones.
That's right.
We really appreciate your spending the time educating us on this. It's an issue focused in California and Southern California, Northern California. But as you know, we have our quiet but sometimes active faults in the Midwest, the New Madrid. And there was an unexpected earthquake in Virginia that's done some real damage to the Washington Monument. So lessons here to learn for the entire nation.
It's not just California, too. It's, you know, the other states that are surrounding us, Oregon, Washington, Utah, Idaho, you know, they all have fairly significant earthquake faults, too. So they're all subjected to very large earthquakes.
Yes, the earth is moving, and we need to be prepared for that.
Yes, that's right.
Thank you very much. We really appreciate your educating us on this important subject.
Okay, very good.
Good to talk to you.
Thanks a lot.